Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. The subtitle for this Talky Bit, which I didn't want to kind of burden the whole, the subject line would have been like lines long. But in my own notes, what I called this to help me sort of focus on where I was going was the practical limits of an ethics of compassion. We were puppy sitting this past week for this lovely, lively puppy named Waffle. One of Waffle's favorite pastimes, and this dog is hilarious, like just like hilarious to watch and be around. She's just a funny dog. One of her favorite pastimes is chasing a tossed tennis ball, which she loves to do. And when she picks it up, it is just the right size for her. Like, her mouth is full, but she can still breathe, right? So she's just like, yeah, I got the big prize. And the problem is, though, that once she gets it in her mouth, she doesn't like to put it down, right? And I think she'll figure it out eventually. But in the meantime, it kind of interferes with the notion of fetch, right? Because it's like, I'm not putting it down. But you want me to throw it again, right? Well, yeah, but I'm not putting it down. You know, and you're kind of stuck in this loop. But it also creates a problem when she tries to bark. Okay, her mouth's full. So we were out in the yard this week, and there was something going on, you know, across the street or whatever, across the creek. And she was like, tennis ball. And then, like, so it came out kind of like, and then she was kind of like, and then she kind of, and then she could get her bark on, you know. But it was hilarious to watch her sort of figure out that she had to spit out the ball to actually bark with some effectiveness. Listening to Waffle trying to bark while her mouth is stuffed with a tennis ball feels to me a little bit like putting this Talky Bit topic where it is in the overall flow of the ideas. It's kind of, there's a danger here that it'll kind of mute the bark of the exploration. It's a little bit like telling the punchline before the joke or at the wrong point in the buildup, you know. If you do that, you either don't get a laugh at all or you just kind of get an awkward chuckle. But I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm going to do it because I believe that I'm doing this exploring with a group of thoughtful people who will probably already be considering some of the problems we're going to start looking at today. And if we don't kind of pull them out and take a good look at them, then they're just going to kind of niggle away in the background and be a distraction. So to make that a little bit more concrete, last time we were exploring this general topic of ethics beyond religion, I said that in part two we would examine some of the reasons for the beyond religion aspect of this. We're still going to do that, but we won't do it in any depth today in part two. We'll get to it later. Today what I want to do is get ahead of that sort of tidy unfolding of the topic by suggesting that if we want to consider what might form the basis for a guiding ethic, to look for a way of thinking as human beings about what might help us work together toward a shared understanding of what the right or better thing is to do, we're most likely, at some point in that kind of an exploration, we're going to end up talking about compassion. Now, just to dip a little bit into the matter of why beyond religion, let me say the obvious. We can, of course, be both religious and compassionate. History is awash in stories of people who have done just that, who continue to do so. Probably most of us can think of someone that we know in the present tense that fits that description. The beyond religion idea is important because we're considering what a more widely shared ethic might look like, one that might work both within and outside of or beyond religion. Why is that important? Well, let me frame the question this way. There's lots of different lenses we could look at that through, but let's just try this. You don't have to answer this question in any kind of public manner. Just consider this for yourself. Were you, at any time in your past, involved in initiatives that had as their goal converting other people to your or your group's religion? I know the answer is for some of you. Evangelism, by any other name. And if you grew up in a religious group that considered its belief system the truth and all other belief systems as something other than or less than the truth, and you were part of recruiting people to join the group, that counts, just to be clear. Anyway, my goal here is not to stir up negative feelings. This isn't about shame or guilt. It's about trying to zoom out and to see things from a wider point of view. So with that in mind, here's part two of that question. If you've ever been part of that kind of an endeavor, or even on the periphery of one, what was your understanding of how many converts would have been enough? It's a rhetorical question, of course, because if the motivation for the evangelism was the notion that the belief system you were sharing held the key to people being saved, let's say, then any caring participant could see that the mission isn't complete until everyone is converted. Right? That's the internal logic is very tidy there. Now, there are, of course, particularly ugly expressions of this that end up as genocide. But there are also kinder expressions of it that give us institutions like hospitals named after saints. Either way, if our goal is to find a way to think about considering what is right or wrong, and we want to do that in a manner that can include the range of humanity, then we need an idea that can work both within and beyond religion. Otherwise, we're just forming a new religion with the particular core value of compassion and trying to convert everyone to our way of belief. Every religion started as a cult, like by definition. It started on the margins. And then when it got enough heft, it became a religion, you know, like historically. So that's all we would be doing. So this is a tricky space for sure. And what I'm going to point toward today, and probably in a couple, we'll probably take a couple of weeks around some of this, because it's a big factor in whether an idea like this could work or not. What might spare the idea of compassion from that sort of fate? I'm going to argue, you can disagree, of course, always, but I'm going to argue that one of the things that might spare compassion from that sort of fate is its innate complexity, essentially its limits. And that might sound a little bit counterintuitive. Why look toward an idea for help, and particularly look for an idea that everyone might be able to work with? Why look for an idea like that if it's limited? Shouldn't it be ultimate? Like, shouldn't it be transcendent? Shouldn't it be universal? I recently watched a grainy old black and white film clip of the elderly Viktor Frankl talking about learning to fly an airplane, which is something he started to do after he was already in his 70s. I just want to be the guy he came to hire, going, well, okay, but I'm keeping my hands on the wheel. You know, he said he always wanted to do it, but he hadn't gotten to it until that point in his life. Now, Frankl, of course, is best known for being a Holocaust survivor. But that said, by the time he entered concentration camps, where he spent, I think, 4 years, he was 37 years old. And he had already spent much of his adult life as a psychiatrist and a neurologist specializing in the treatment of suicidal patients. And his lasting contribution has been to the field of psychology with his recognition of meaning as a central factor in mental health, which is in itself a very interesting idea, at least to me, and his advocacy that the psychologist's role was primarily to help their patients find meaning, hence his best-known book, Man's Search for Meaning, the second half of which outlines his particular approach to therapy. Logotherapy. Maybe that's why he didn't get the flying airplanes for fun until a little bit later in his life. In any case, in this film clip from this public lecture, he talks about how flying a small plane in a crosswind helped him learn about how we sometimes need to aim at a target other than the one we intend to reach in order to hit the one we intended. I didn't learn this in flying an airplane. I learned this lesson in canoes, right? Like if you want to get from this island to that island and the wind's blowing this way, what did you say, Shereen? You bowl in a crosswind? No, I know the curve. No, I was actually tracking that, believe it or not, right? But like, if the wind's blowing this way, and I want to get from here to the post, and I aim at the post, I'm going to end up over by the door, right? I got to aim over here, and the wind's going to push this way, and I'm going to push this way, and if we balance it out nicely, we get where we intended to go. We need to aim at an ideal in ways that take reality, that take limitations into account, or we're not going to end up anywhere close to where we expected that ideal to draw us toward. We're going to just plain miss it and end up, you know, in the ocean instead of on the island, right? Maybe it's a little bit like navigating by a star. Like, we can never get to the star, but aiming at it can help us get somewhere that's more approachable with less time spent wandering around in the dark. It can actually help us get where we want or need to go. The ideal that I'm thinking of in all of that illustrating is compassion. We did a whole series a while back on nuanced compassion, in which we explored not only the sort of the nurturing being with someone side of compassion, which is kind of close to the central definition of compassion, but also what we called the fierce side of compassion, more like the mother bear defending her cubs aspect of compassion, which kind of can get sold short as like a big warm fuzzy, you know? It's actually got a lot more heft than that to it. Compassion is a big, complex idea. That said, I think it's also a very accessible, practical one. And what I want to do in the balance of this exploration is suggest that helping people, so this is kind of my starting point, helping people, being compassionate, is a good thing. It makes life more livable for every one of us, it makes life more livable for those around us, and it makes the world a better place and is, for the most part, good for society. It helps us make better societies. And it's hard. It really sounds obvious that, to me at least, that being compassionate is a good choice. It's a good idea, like telling the truth is a good idea. But ideas like this can also be like that guiding star notion that we touched on a moment ago. They can be essential guides for us, but if we're not also practical in considering how and why we aim at them, we might end up just giving up in frustration. We're just going to bail. It's good to be compassionate, but there are some things about life as we experience it that make it hard to stay that way. Compassion fatigue, right? We hear that phrase in the news. And today I want to point out one of those in particular, more in an illustrative way than in a prescriptive or exhaustive way. So if we're interested in living a compassionate life, we can do so with our hearts open and also with our heads up and our eyes watching for the challenges that might entail. So perhaps with more wisdom and less naive, if you will. Here's the way I'm going to sort of try to encapsulate the particular problem I'll use to illustrate from today. And we'll do some others as we go. But for today, just this one. It's hard to be compassionate all the time with everyone. We are awash in information. And the news that sells best is bad news. It fires us up, and we stay on the channel. It's a pretty logical connection. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody has measured this. I didn't take the time to dig into it. If you know the answer, let's talk about it later. But I'm not sure if there are more needs in the world right now than there have been in the past. I think that might be a bit difficult to quantify. There are more people, so it's probably reasonable to say that there are also more people in need. By that logic, there are also more people with resources to help. But I suspect that if we were to define needs in some measurable, quantifiable way and consider what percentage of people met the definition, we might find that the percentage was actually lower than in the past. Because for much of humanity, life has been brutal for most of our species. Now, whether that's a valid perspective or not, what I do feel confident about is that we are inundated with information about those needs in the present tense in ways that have not been common throughout history. I'm fascinated by how readily people agree with me when I suggest that our technology is evolving faster than we are, even people who love it. You know, and I think that there's connected to fear, I think, but also it's not that hard to see. What I want to use as an illustration here contains the danger of sounding nostalgic. When all I knew about the needs of the world was what I could see and hear with my own eyes and ears, what essayist Wendell Berry calls localism, what got conveyed to me in a material way by the story that a visitor told me, perhaps, if it was news from further away, but an actual physical visitor, then my neighbor was actually my literal next-door neighbor. Under those kind of circumstances, the idea of living a compassionate life operates on a different scale. I'm not saying that it was easier, but I am saying that we weren't attempting to do it with access to information about the suffering of most of the humans on the planet showing up on our screen anytime, all the time. One of the results of being constantly exposed to the horrors of the world is that we can get jaded. We can get basically inured to suffering. When suffering is always in the viewfinder, we often experience the need to find ways to deflect or to diffuse the impact of that. To say that it's a survival strategy, I think is true, but I think it also might make it too easy to justify. However, it can also help us make sense of our own behavior and grow in our understanding of why staying compassionate can be quite difficult. When we are constantly seeing suffering, we have a tendency to rationalize why those who are suffering deserve it, why we can't do anything about it, why it's okay to ignore it. And this perspective can help us understand why belief systems that teach it'll all be fixed by a greater power someday have so much heft to them. They've got so much horsepower. They address our own experiences of tremendously profound inadequacies, limitations, felt needs, that whole bundle of overwhelm that can come with that. If we can convince ourselves that problem X is beyond our purview, then we can either ideologically or practically or both walk around it, step over it, without being so torn up inside. The bumper sticker version is not my problem. And that makes living a compassionate life challenging. That makes it hard. It also means that we're vulnerable to a way of thinking that means nothing changes. It might go a bit like this. If the problem is so big, so pervasive, that I think I can't do anything about it, then a very rational, a very logical response to that is to do nothing. Can't do anything about it. Or if the problem lacks an obvious solution, or if I think the solutions being suggested by whoever has the power to implement them are based on faulty thinking or perhaps even deception, I might choose to hold off on supporting a solution. The upshot is that the problem remains because people, starting with me, are doing nothing about it. It is perhaps roughly analogous to traveling in a country where English isn't the first language and saying the same thing louder and louder. You know, like it's like, but nothing's happening. Maybe I'll just try the same thing again. Except in this case, we're saying nothing louder and louder. I'm basically going to leave us with the dilemma today. We'll keep exploring, but I want to leave us with an old wisdom story about this that puts us, I think, right in the middle of the conundrum. I'm always watching for these sorts of stories, partly because I think they travel well. They have survived in many different cultural contexts, and they still have something of value to teach us. So back to the joke that if you're listening to this on the podcast, you won't have heard that I started with about why would we stay stuck in the same story, right? This does circle back to that. Like, why do some of these stories still work, even though clearly their context is not our context? And I think it's because they potentially at least have something still to say to us. This one has its origins in terms of geography and the details somewhere coastal, so translate as necessary. But the story goes like this. There's a man who's walking beside the ocean, walking down the beach. It sounds good, right? Walking down the beach with a friend, even better. And whatever the variables are that have caused this, thousands of starfish have washed ashore, and they're stranded there, and they're drying out in the sand. And as they're walking along, this guy starts picking them up one at a time and tossing them back in the ocean. And his friend says, like, what are you doing? You know, I mean, why bother? You can't save them all. And he says, no, you know, you're right, but I saved that one. And that one. And that one. Right? Operationally, that's the dilemma right there. Like most wise stories, this one doesn't solve the problem as much as it keeps it in front of us. And it stirs our own imagination if we will allow it, if that story speaks to us. This is, of course, we could sort of expand this to experiences that perhaps many of us have had with sacred texts, right? Where we feel like, I can't even crack that book at this point. It just makes me ill or makes me go, why don't I read some other ancient mythology instead of this one or whatever, right? But it's not connecting. Well, then that's not the story that'll speak to me, right? It stopped speaking. So then I'm fundamentally wasting my time there. But I do need to find stories that speak to me, that collect wisdom over time. Otherwise, I'm feeding right into the kind of the capitalist dilemma, if you will, that we talked about earlier, where we start to think about the ultimate goal as individualized actualization instead of connection to others and community, right? It's just a question of what the details are. But when stories speak to us, one of the things that wisdom stories consistently do, whatever their source might be, is they keep the problem in front of us. They keep us asking the big questions. If, I don't say things with this tone very often. This is not where I get to the Jesus is disappointed in you part. But I don't use should language very often because it's not my place unless there's some dialogue going on around it. So I want to be careful of that here. But I also want to say that I feel strongly about this, that I believe this. I believe that we do not serve ourselves or our communities well if we live lives bereft of wisdom stories. This is not about commending a particular collection of stories for me. It's about saying our viewfinder as humans is too small as an individual to actually keep the big problems in view in ways that are helpful. For that, we need big stories. We need stories that have traveled, that are wizened, that have the wrinkle marks of time and are still here. And we can find them in lots of different places, but we need to find them and we need to attend to them. We need to let them speak to us. We might not want that to happen because it can be disquieting. It can even be distressing. But if the alternative to that unrest is that we don't pick up what we can, then nothing changes. And that, I think, is worth exploring, which, as much as it's up to me, we will continue to do when we return to the series in a couple of weeks. Peace.